such meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed.
Millennia ago, from the little cave on the tiny island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, the heavens opened. Since then, the world has been fascinated by the cosmic upheaval brewing on the horizon of history. The upheaval is now upon us. It is within us. To some degree, it always has been. But there has been a sudden and violent shift in the affairs of the world. The winds have changed. Heaven will not be silent. Let's now join Father Anthony Bush, pastor of St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago, and author of A Mother's Plea, For the Winds Have Changed. Together we can pave the way for a hopeful response to the signs of our times.
Hey, welcome everyone. God bless you for tuning in to The Winds of Change on a whether you're live on a Wednesday afternoon at noon, our lunch hour, Catholic hour, or you're checking in on podcasts, welcome. Father Tom Coyce here. It's been a while since I've done a live show, unfortunately, but I hope when you're... Yeah. That's busy schedules. Squish me off, you know. That's what happens in life. I'm sure we all know that.
I am the gift.
This is, here, Winds of Change is the gift, right? You gotta keep it in your podcast list. You gotta catch up what's going on with all the interesting news of the day, keeping abreast of deeper theological insights, historical insights, psychological ones, what have you. Anyways, I gotta start out. I'm gonna try to split the show into two segments here. Sometimes I try to do that and it doesn't get done, but I'm going to try. I'll tell you that at the outset. So we'll spend a little time talking about something that's flying under the radar screen. And one of the things that a radio show is supposed to do is to help publicize things that you might not hear about. And there's this act again coming up, presented in Washington, called the Equality Act. We got to figure out what this means, and we have to see the damage that it can be done, and that is being done, as it were, to moral principles and the classic sense of morals being founded on evaluation of human acts. That's why I'm going to introduce this topic. I'm sure if you're a news junkie like most radio listeners are, we have to, you know the basics. Nancy Pelosi introduced the so-called Equality Act, a bill that would add sexual orientation and gender identity as protected classes under the federal civil rights law. You're a protected class of persons. In other words, like in the 60s when the civil rights bill created protection for black people, African-American people, for no other reason than for being black. There was all sorts of ways to try to see that a person is equal under the law based on not that discrimination against someone for something they have no choice in the matter of. Of course, this is where you're going to get into scientific arguments and debates. Or that is not a part of any moral system, as it were, something that you're born with. So that did a lot to help advance the understanding that humans come in many shapes, sizes, and colors. and that there it is good not to treat another differently, poorly, especially treat someone else. We're treating others differently today because of skin color, but not.
You just wrinkled my brain, man.
Yeah, that's the brain wrinkling issue of the day. So I want to address two things at the outset. One is how this way of thinking that is pushing sexual orientation and gender identity is ruining our way of thinking. We're changing the way we're thinking, and it's a strange thing, I gotta say, is because moral relativity grew out of a strong attention to consequences. I'll say it this way: in evaluating the rightness or the wrongness of a particular action, and I underline that word action, a human action, in evaluating the rightness or wrongness of a particular human action, consequences were king. In other words, what you did in and of itself, that's kind of a classic formulation right there. An act in and of itself, outside of the consequences, was relegated to a very inconsequential step in our evaluation process. All that mattered was the consequences. And so the attention paid to consequences developed what we in the moral sphere call situational ethics, where you evaluate what we do quite often in many areas of life. When you have a decision to make, sometimes people even do this literally, right? Take out a piece of paper and weigh the pros and cons, we say, right? You weigh the pros and cons. That's our way of paying attention to consequences, right? There's some good consequences and some bad consequences. And you weigh the two, and the one that has the better positive consequences is the way you go. And therefore, a whole way of thinking grew out of this, shall we say, a discovery or a focusing, shining the spotlight on consequences, not only just primarily, but exclusively, forgetting an evaluation of what we would call an act in itself. Okay, so that that happened through the 60s and 70s and 80s, or even earlier than that, you could trace that kind of moral relativism or the consequentialism all the way back to David Hume or Immanuel Kant, people of the 1700s, 1800s. But anyways, we're dealing with that today. And as a Catholic priest who tries to think about these topics, I want to say that consequences are important. We do consider consequences. But here's the strange twist that this Equality Act is thrown at us. The Equality Act is ignoring the consequences of human acts at this point. What do I mean by that? There is a new way of thinking that would say, it doesn't matter what the consequences of a human act are. We're going to call two different kinds of human acts equal, regardless of the consequences. I think I have to spell it out a little bit clearer, because I know I'm talking on a philosophical theoretical level. Let me bring it down. What's behind the Equality Act and the desire to put in some kind of legislation, the idea that someone's sexual orientation, if one is gay or not, basically, or someone's gender identity, whether someone considers themselves a male with male biology or a female with male biology or female biology, or vice versa, you know, that. Those are these are the acts that we're talking about. We're lifting these up. We're analyzing these human acts. And what I'm saying is that this Equality Act is now reversing the spotlight on the consequences, because the consequences don't matter. Here's what I mean. Take two human acts, the man and the woman that embrace each other. This is a family show, so we'll use good family language, right? A man and a woman embrace each other in what we oftentimes call the marital act. And it is very possible that a child will come around 9 months later. That's the consequence of that embrace, okay? Consequences, again, are important, and they're part of our acts, are part of our evaluation of the rightness or wrongness of an act. So, but to say that two men who embrace each other and do what two men would do, and to say that that is equal to what a man and a woman do when they embrace each other, and to say that there's equality there, that what is equal is not the consequences. See what I'm saying? The Equality Act has turned the focus of attention away from the consequences of the act, because obviously two men doing what they do will never have to worry about, is there another mouth to feed, which is a crude way of saying that a man and a woman don't want another child. It's a sad sad kind of attitude, but it's understandable if one is really struggling in a lot of ways. That's why people that have larger families are oftentimes admired, because they accept the child, even though they may have to make a lot of personal sacrifices to raise that child, or the children that they have, right? So that's the first thing I want to say about this Equality Act. It's ruining our way of thinking again, and it's very logical that a source of evil would use a moral principle when it's convenient, and then discard it when it's inconvenient, when there's another motivation or there's another desire. What is equal about those two human acts? And again, I say politely, because we are in a wonderful, this is a Catholic radio show.
You just wrinkled my brain, man.
Yeah, what is equal about it is not the consequences, but one might say, well, what's equal is that they both give pleasure to the people involved in those acts, right? Obviously, some people might laugh and say, you know, a lot of times, unfortunately, women, when I talk about their marriage situations, and they're, especially if they're having a difficulty in their marriage, will say, oh, I haven't enjoyed time with my husband for years and years. You know, it's never pleasurable. And you could understand that, but there should be and there can be obviously pleasure in that marital embrace, we call it. So to say we're going to make these very radically different kinds of human acts equal is to focus only on the pleasure principle of the two acts. Both give pleasure. And so the other consequences of the act are inconsequential. It's kind of where that word comes from, isn't it? So it's an abuse of that moral thinking, and we should expect that from an evil source. We should expect that from someone who's trying to destroy and tear down. You use certain tools for when they're your advantage, and you will take away those tools from someone else if they're going to build something contrary to your ultimate desires. And so it's just a sad corruption of thinking, and it's playing on the way most Americans have trained themselves to think. Well, first of all, they train themselves to think exclusively on consequences, and now we're going to say consequences. Acts don't have consequences, so you can call both things equal. I think we want to take a little break here. We're running along in our hour. I want to address myself to another aspect of this bill that's probably going to go through. I want to address myself to you who voted for Biden and didn't think such things matter, or you're okay with it, as it were. So let's take a quick break, and we'll be right back. I'm Father Tom Coyes. You're listening to listener-supported The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
You are invited to a series of Father Anthony's reflections on prayer entitled Lex Orandi, Lex Credendi, Lex Vivendi. As we pray, so we believe. As we believe, so we live. These reflections will be presented each Thursday during Lent on Winds of Change. Join us at noon weekdays on AM 750. You can also download the podcast and listen anytime to Winds of Change.
We are the students of St. Stan LaCosta Academy.
Your children can join them for face-to-face classroom instruction. Visit ststanschicago.org to find out how.
And you're listening to The Winds of Change.
Here's some good news. We are pleased to announce that St. Stanislaus Kostka is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, in answer to our Blessed Mother's call to open the doors. The Blessed Sacrament will again be exposed all day, every day, except when masses or other services are being held. You are invited to come and pray anytime, day or night. For your safety, we ask that you practice social distancing and wear a mask. Hand sanitizer is available, and St. Stan's has increased cleaning and sanitizing of the church, and a security person will be on site. More information can be found at ststanschurch.org. That's ststanschurch.org. St. Stanislaus Kostka is located 2 blocks north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. Trying to get my head around this Equality Act that's being shoved through our hollow halls of Congress in Washington, D.C. It's a sad situation that we have to deal with. And I was trying to explain in the opening segment how consequences first were everything, and now in this strange way, consequences mean nothing. I'll continue my analogy here, or the example playing out, to show how consequences have to be included in our evaluation of acts. If two acts are going to be equal, then consequences would be equal as well. Imagine a man who's having an affair outside of his marriage, and I'll put this question: would the man having an affair outside of his marriage, if he's with a woman or with a man create any differences in that affair? On the psychological, on the heartfelt side of the man's wife, let us say, she will she'll be hurt either way, right? If the man goes out and has an affair with a woman, she'll be hurt. She'll be thinking, well, who am I? Chopped liver. Why did you get attracted to her and not me? Blah, blah, blah. There's obviously lots of room for hurt. If the man went out and had an affair with a man, she would say, oh my goodness, I didn't know I married a gay man. But other than that, what's the big difference? Isn't it? It's kind of obvious, isn't it? That the consequences of the man having an affair with a woman would be that there may be a baby around. Us in our modern society think, oh, how stupid. All you do is have to use artificial contraception and you fix that problem. That is the fix of the consequence, but that creates another new problem of a different kind, obviously related. But I'm concentrating here on just the natural consequences of what is a relation, a marital embrace between man and woman, and an embrace that is an embrace between a man and a man that is not a marital embrace, although that's what people are arguing about, the meaning of the word. So obviously, if the man went out and had an affair with another man, there's no chance of a baby becoming part of the mess and part of the problem. And we could think of all sorts of family situations where a man did have another child with another woman, and then that affects the relationship between the children involved, right? We call them half brothers or half sisters, a child will most likely or probably look at the woman who is his mother as more precious in his eyes or her eyes than his or her half-brother or sister who is child of another woman, not his dad's mother and father, his wife. And so the consequences begin to multiply. And obviously these are the things that are often involved in difficult family situations, and we're constantly trying to make it better. And we should try to make it better, because certainly there are a lot of families like that have these difficult situations. And but my point is that if the man goes out and has an affair with another man, there's no consequences like that are going to ensue. So to say that the two acts are equal is illogical. It's silly, because they would only be able to establish their equality in the sense that they both give pleasure. And in a hedonistic society, that's really the most important value. And so these other consequences are inconsequential. But the real world that we live in teaches us that they are consequential, very consequential. Another aspect of this Equality Act that I want to touch on, I want to address myself to those people who did vote for Biden and thought they were primarily voting for a person who would stop a divisive movement in the nation. Namely, they saw that President Trump was creating division. They think that it was President Trump that was creating division. And in some sense, he was, because he was talking in such a way where people were able to see more clearly what position they wanted to take on this or that. He didn't create the positions, but he shed light on them. So, but a number of people, I'm sure, with good intentions in their heart, voted for Biden and thought that this will create greater unity and diminish divisiveness, will make civil discourse in vogue again, as opposed to arguing. But I have to call attention to the fact that something like the Equality Act was very much a part of the Biden campaign platform, as it were. The constant references to trying to make things equal for our brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, cousins and nieces and nephews, even parents who have gone the way of a gay marriage or have gone through a surgery to change their gender. These people, Biden said he would do these kind of things, and it didn't matter to his voters, because they weren't voting for the Equality Act. They were voting for more peaceful, less caustic, less bombastic, more civil discourse. And what needs to be appreciated is that those voices and political leaders in general are often following the pulse of society. They're not really creating the pulse of society. There is this division between the heart and soul of us all, that there is a major difference between a marital embrace between a man and a woman and what is called a marital embrace between a man and a man. So you can't rub that out, as it were. And somebody will say very quickly, it doesn't matter to me what the guy does next door in the privacy of his bedroom. And I get that. I could see it doesn't really matter. It doesn't affect that person's life. It's something that you can ignore. It's something that you can celebrate it, I guess, if you want. But if you don't have a real personal connection with that person, then obviously what they do in their personal life doesn't affect you. But when we hear that, or when we say those kinds of things, I need you to ask yourself, okay, what if it wasn't your neighbor or the guy down the street or the woman down the street who is engaging in such a thing or doing that operation? What if it wasn't that anonymous person down the street, but what if it was one of your children? You'd say, okay, does that affect you? Well, and you could say, well, it shouldn't affect you. Those who would be for the Equality Act, you should say, it shouldn't affect you. You should accept them and praise them and love them, regardless of your preference for a marital embrace between a man and a woman, or the fact that a biologically born boy should stay a boy and turn into a man, obviously, a girl to a woman. So it's a middle case between the neighbor, the anonymous neighbor down the street who you don't really care about, versus someone in your own family. Could be one of your children, or it could be a brother and sister. Okay. Now, that's the middle ground, I say, because there's even a deeper example that I need you to consider in order to see, are you going to stand by the moral principle that it doesn't matter what someone else does in the privacy of their home? let's take it another notch deeper. And can you hold on to that way of thinking if it were your wife or husband? That brings it to a different level. Can you still say it doesn't matter what he or she does in the privacy of someplace? If you're talking about your spouse, if that's the case, and that would have to be the case if you're going to be logically consistent about this. And this is where I need you to focus on, because it's one thing to say it's the anonymous person down the street. It's another thing to say it's one of your relatives. But let's, like I say, take it up a notch. What if it's your spouse? Can you defend that position by saying it doesn't matter what he or she does? If you can say that, you really have gone full circle, and you've just created the kind of attitude about human love, about the family, that is super pagan, super hedonistic, the open, free marriage kind of lifestyle. You could see a husband and a wife kissing each other goodbye as they both go off to work in the morning. And let us say the wife says to her husband, "Oh, I'm sorry, I won't be coming home tonight. Maybe you could pick up a pizza or something. I'm having a little, I'm meeting one of my lesbian friends at a motel, and we'll probably stay the night. So we'll see you tomorrow, okay, honey?" And if the guy said, "Okay, no problem, have a good time, dear," he'd say, wait a minute. Does that guy treasure the kind of bond and the kind of romantic relationship he has with that woman, his wife? Obviously, it could twist the story around and make it the man going out. But you see what I'm saying? That casual attitude that it doesn't matter what the other person is doing, it works as long as you're not personally involved in those other people. Now, here's the problem. How does God look at us all? Does when God looks at you and he looks at me, are one of us the anonymous person down the street that he doesn't care about? Does God care about me, but not about you, because you're the anonymous person that lives down the street? And no, that's not what we think about when we think about God. When we think about God, he's going to care about me as much as he cares about you. So I'm bringing this to the floor because just like a husband and a wife would say, yes, it does matter what you're doing when you're not coming home on time after work or whatever. But God has that kind of relationship with all of us. We're all his children, and we're all his spouse in a sense. That's where the Catholic teaching about the church being this the spouse of the Lord is very powerful. The Lord can't ignore or be casual about the behavior of so-and-so down the street because he doesn't care about them so much. There's no personal relationship with them. And this beckons us to think about the Blessed Trinity, my friends, the image of God as Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, as a communion of persons, different, distinct persons, but equal in dignity. It provides a credible example for us humans to try to imitate and fulfill our destiny because we're made in that image.
Wow.
And so
you just wrinkled my brain, man.
Yeah, that is brain wrinkling. And that's where a pagan, let us say, go back to a pagan world. And when we think of that, we think of, at least I do, the world, the Roman Empire before or outside of Jesus and the Christians, right? But more and more today, when I say the pagan world, I could also imagine and think of the typical public school community, or sad to say, even some of the secular Catholic schools. You're not living your life in the shadow of a God you worship that is Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, that is three persons, equal in dignity, united with one God, three persons. That mysterious Trinity is calling us to imitate the God we worship. And so therefore, this tendency to strangerize us everybody else. I just came up with that word. I think that's a pretty good word. Strangerize someone is to not really care about them as persons, but to, you know, you don't want them to get hit by a car. You care for them that they're comfortable and all the rest, but you don't really care about them in the sense that you love them and want the best for them. We strangerize so many people, and actually, that's one of the consequences of believing in God and starting to be more religious. You start to unstrangerize everybody in your life, which is to start thinking them as brothers and sisters. And so, this is an aspect. This was predicted. This is what the Bidens and Pelosi were pushing, and when people voted for them that didn't think about this, they should have thought about it. They were hoping that it would just be a movement toward more civility and away from arguing. It doesn't work that way, my friends. It's not that simple. Just say let's all get along without trying to solve the problems that cause division. It's like childish, and we have to be more mature than that. Okay, well, I promised the second half, and I want to talk about today's the feast of Saint Catherine Drexel, and it reminds me of some wonderful American history that we got to touch on. So let's take a quick break, and we'll come right back. I'm Father Tom Coyes. You're listening to listener-supported The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
St. Stan's needs your help. We are forming a group of volunteers called St. Stan's Cares to help parish and school families in times of need. To join the group or learn more, please contact Brian at 312-343-3222, and we will plan an upcoming virtual meeting to discuss the details. Almsgiving, it's one of the three pillars of Lent. Volunteer with St. Stan's Cares as a means of almsgiving.
We are the students of St. Stan LaCosta Academy.
Your children can join them for face-to-face classroom instruction. Visit ststanschicago.org to find out how.
And you're listening to The Winds of Change.
Have you thought about the importance of almsgiving this Lent? The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops teaches us that during Lent, we are asked to focus more intently on almsgiving. In the Book of Tobit, the Archangel Raphael gives great counsel to Tobit and his son Tobias that you and I should heed as well. Quote, "Prayers with fasting and alms with right conduct are better than riches with iniquity. Better to practice almsgiving than to hoard up gold," end quote. And he adds, now listen to this astounding promise. Almsgiving saves from death and purges every kind of sin. Those who give alms have their fill of days. Wow, I'm in. How about you? I'm Jim Littleton, forming faithful families. God love you.
Hey, welcome back. Father Tom Coyce here with you, Winds of Change. It was good to hear Jim Littleton's voice there. Very interesting guy. I hope you... he also has a book with the most amazing title called Cured by Cancer, how his battle with cancer brought him so much closer to the true meaning of life and close to God. And praise be to God, he was healed in a lot of different ways. I think he's still fighting it now. That's been years since that battle, the initial battle started, but boy, he's done wonderful. But anyways, God bless you, Jim Littleton, and all your wonderful family. Anyways, okay, what I want to touch on, so that what time we have left, is today's the feast of St. Catherine Drexel, and she was a sister here in America. She was an American. And it reminds me of her, reminds me of the Wild Wild West. She saw, she was in that half a century after the Civil War, 40, 50 years, the time after the American Civil War until the early 1900s. And of course, a lot of the black people who were freed wanted to run away from the plantations they were slaves in. And so obviously many, many went north, some went west, and some obviously stayed in the South. It was quite a challenge for them. And they were a pitiful lot. They needed help. They had this new freedom, but who was going to help them figure out how to do live their life, as it were? So she formed a group of sisters, and they did a lot, establishing schools and hospitals and classes and training, not only for the newly freed black people, but also for the Indians. And the Indians out west are still another, it's a different kind of minority. And a lot of the Indian people were a poor lot after they, as strong and as warrior-like as many, some of the tribes, like the Sioux, the great Sioux Indians, and there were a lot of warrior tribe. Iroquois were very much prone to wars and fighting. But anyways, they weren't a match for the American armies. There were battles, like the little battle of Bighorn out there in South Dakota. And but they were, in a sense, brought to their knees, and many of the chiefs and a lot of the Indians knew they were not a match in terms of just going toe to toe in a war type situation. They tried, but obviously time told. So, anyways, but a lot of Indians then, they embraced Christianity. They embraced Catholicism especially. And a big part of that was St. Catherine Drexel. And there's another Chicago connection. A priest by the name of Francis Clement Kelly was also very instrumental in helping the Native American Indians. And I just got to share with you, he should be someone we're familiar with. He's the founder of what we now know as the Catholic Church Extension Society. I got to read a little bit of his bio here. He was the second bishop of Oklahoma. He was born in 1870 in Canada, Prince Edward Island. His Irish father was a sea trader, so Francis was formed in a one-room country school in the Gales off the coast of Nova Scotia. From the first, he excelled at writing. In high school, he started a newspaper and won the English medal. He would go on to publish 17 books, countless articles and short stories, and launched a national magazine, not as a journalist, but as a Catholic priest. For while preparing for his catechism final, he had felt the unrefusable call to the priesthood. So he was ordained a priest for the Diocese of Detroit, Michigan. Father Kelly's first assignment set the spark to the tinder that fired his life's work. The Lampier, Michigan parish was a rundown dry goods box of a church with no sacristy, no statues, no stained glass windows, only a pile of dirty vestments. So Father Kelly, the poverty of his parish spoke of a cold, calculating indifference to God. The culprit was the previous pastor removed for apostasy, who lingered in Lampier, writing Herbert Spencer-inspired articles for the weekly paper. The 22-year-old Father Kelly rallied his disillusioned parishioners with sermons rich in doctrine and delivered with clarity and wit. Under Kelly, a brick-and-mortar building project began in earnest, but stalled while the young priest donned his country's uniform to fight in the Spanish-American War, where they fought over the islands in the Caribbean that were under the control of Spain. He says later in his memoirs, no one could have had a stronger conviction that the war with Spain was not only unjust but unnecessary. Boy, I agree with him there on that. That's where President Roosevelt got the name Bully, where he stormed the beaches of the island. Anyways.
Wow.
American.
You just wrinkled my brain, man.
Yeah, that's part of history, right? It's good to know our history. Kelly later wrote, but as an army chaplain, he was able to bring the sacraments to soldiers and help them. Kelly's brush with early American imperialism informed his thought on war. War is sometimes justified, though not often. Because not often is there a right side and a wrong side, mostly there are only two wrong sides. Wouldn't that be great if we could settle our sides without killing each other? What glory there had been in the clash of a sword on armor had long since vanished. What is idealistic about a tank? Can poetry come out of a gas mask? He asked. When war becomes a matter of test tubes, and it is fast coming to that, the last vestige of idealism will have disappeared from it. The scientist is killing war, for he preparing to make it so horrible and loathsome that mankind is bound to stricken of it and vomit it out of his mouth. Pray God forever. He's somewhat of a prophet there, saying that test tubes will be new weapons. Can we see that as we contemplate the virus that we're fighting with? There are a number of wise people that are saying it's a chemical attack on the country. It was a biological warfare. You remember how we hated that term and we were fearful that it was going to happen in the Middle East. But there's a lot of people saying that China was instrumental. It was it's a good way to bring down America. We got to remember that, folks, that there are people that would like to see America fall or else be taken over by other very radically different thinking folks. Returning to Michigan, Father Kelly joined a Lyceum circuit, kind of a preacher's circuit to give speeches, and his honorarium funded the construction of his parish. His audiences ranged from small boys throwing peanut shells to old ladies who looked with disapproval at the first Catholic priest they had ever seen while wondering how he concealed his horn so cleverly, unquote. Sharing the circuit with great orators like Bob LaFollette and William Jennings Bryan, Father Kelly came face to face with Middle America gathered in meeting halls, red schoolhouses, vacant shops, and tents. He came face to face with the miserable living and working conditions endured by Catholic priests among the scattered people and the churchless places of America West and South. He resolved to found a home mission society to bring the faith to many regions of America overrun with poverty, prejudice, and ignorance. A column he wrote in the Ecclesiastical Review of Philadelphia launched the Catholic Extension Society. Reprinted as a pamphlet, Kelly's little shanty story described ramshackle rectory of a Catholic pastor in Kansas. The pamphlet captured the hearts of Catholics across the Republic in poor donations. One captured heart was that of Archbishop James Quigley, who we know here in Chicago. And on the feast of St. Luke the Evangelist in 1905, the Catholic Church Extension Society was founded in Quigley's hometown of Chicago. Within a year, Kelly's bishop gave him the right to transfer to Chicago. Kelly excelled as a fundraiser, but his public candor about the lack of missionary spirit in the American seminaries and his scathing criticism of the American hierarchy's neglect of Catholic rural America made him East Coast enemies, including the papal delegate, Archbishop Diamonde Falconio. Quigley stuck by Kelly and arranged meetings for him in Rome to obtain Vatican approval for the society. To Kelly, Pope Pius X was a saint who saw no obstacle to holiness and the possession of a fund of humor. But it was the Pope's Secretary of State, Cardinal Marie Delval, was the first great and powerful Roman friend of the Catholic Church Extension Society. He instructed Kelly in the science of untying hard diplomatic knots. Untying hard diplomatic knots. Lessons the priest would apply throughout his life. That reminds me, that's an interesting, let me come up to the present day. Trump, you would say, never did go to diplomatic core school. And that's part of the reason why he became successful in a lot of ways, because people get tired of the slow movement of diplomatic negotiations. But especially Catholic priests and Catholic bishops are quite the opposite of a Trumpster, and that's probably why a lot of them don't buy into him. They say, well, wait a minute. We know there's differences of opinion in so many different people, but you can't just go and point them out, or you just can't tell people they're wrong, or we got to change this. You can't be a bull in a china shop, as it were. You have to use this diplomatic skills, which is what this article on Francis Clement Kelly is saying that Father Kelly got in his work with the Extension Society. So one triumph of the Extension Society was a fleet of chapel train cars, the St. Anthony, the St. Peter, and the St. Paul. Kelly's immediate inspiration was a Baptist train car he had seen at the St. Louis World Fair. In an article in the Extension Society, Kelly argued that if the Baptists could take the gospel on the rails, so could the Catholics. The idea was older than that, of course. Pio Nono had used a purple painted train car complete with a throne room to travel throughout the Papal States. And Russian Orthodox priests employed rolling chapels, exquisitely adorned, to take the divine liturgy to rural towns along the Trans-Siberian Railroad. Kelly's rail cars were beautifully fitted as well, with art treasures from Europe, including an 11th century crucifix. The cars sat 70 people for Mass, and included confessionals and a little place for the priest to sleep. So, Father Kelly's rolling chapels restored the sacraments to countless fallen away Catholics all over rural America. Undoubtedly, this is where he would have met Catherine Drexel as she tried to establish. That's where this all comes from, my friends, because we're remembering St. Catherine Drexel today. The Extension Society priests baptized and confirmed witness marriages, absolved sin, dispensed extreme unction, and offered the Holy Sacrifice of the Mass throughout the West. In many towns where the rail cars planted the seed of faith, chapels and churches sprang up. supported by Extension Society dollars and constructed by the faithful who had returned home. Kelly helped finance the work of the Extension Society with his magazine, which at its peak boasted over 500,000 subscribers. A Catholic version of the Saturday Evening Post, the quarterly spread the word about the Society's work, thereby attracting donations. Extension's magazine also included articles in apologetics, poetry, and short stories, including scores of mystery stories penned by Kelly himself. So popular was the magazine that when America entered the First World War, Kelly received the offer of a substantial sum in exchange for an editorial endorsing Woodrow Wilson's intervention in Europe. Kelly declined, passing up his one and only chance to become rich, he later said. The Pigs of Serbia, a scathing rebuke of the war and its promoters on both sides of the Atlantic, he wrote. American meddling in the affairs of Europe was not the only U.S. foreign policy that provoked Father Kelly's anger. The Mexican question, mishandled by administrations from Taft to Coolidge, became a focus of Kelly's life and perhaps the one for which he is best known today. The resulting book, Blood-Drenched Altars, is his only work still in print. Marvelous book that's on my shelf. That was my comment, not in the article I'm reading you. It's a great article, and it's helped me appreciate what really went on in Mexico. The volume argues that Mexico under Spain was a beautiful Catholic country, even culturally superior to the United States in many ways in the 1800s. They dotted the land with architectural triumphs, which to this day have not been equaled in the Americas. If you go to the colonial towns in Mexico, those are the ones that most tourist places go there. They're, you feel like you're stepping into Europe in a lot of ways. So that's what he's relating there. Moreover, the book, written for and distributed to every member of the United States Congress in 1935, shows America's considerable culpability in, to use Kelly's words, the Great Steal. That is, the deliberate fomenting of the revolutions since the 1800s that replaced Catholic Mexico with Marxist Mexico. Boy, now here's something very important, my friends. This is why I really encourage you to look at his book and see. He takes on these things. I don't know that many of the writings of Catherine Drexel, but she probably wouldn't have got into these bigger societal issues. She would have been trying to teach the children like a beautiful mother, right? And get them to love one another in the family. But this also is part of the story, and we can't abandon that side. I'll continue here reading. Kelly and his fellow bishop, Michael Joseph, Iron Mike Curley of Baltimore, were the two American bishops who loudly opposed America's support of Masonic revolution in Mexico and worked to relieve the suffering of clergy in a country the government of which had formally declared war on the Catholic Church. The Extension Society funded a seminary for exiled Mexican seminarians in Texas, just west of San Antonio. Isn't it powerful? And as we think of the challenges today, my friends, it's easy to see Catholics turning against Catholicism. It's what we have to pray for every day. God bless you for listening to The Winds of Change. This is Father Tom Coyes, a listener-supported Winds of Change. You've been listening to Winds of Change on.
What's there to say when the world makes no sense? Do we search deeper truths or sit on the fence? Can you see? Can you see? Meaningless thought, the shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred, the time is now, the winds have changed. Read the signs, no time to hide.